We are now in the second chapter of the Book of Esther. Remember with me how easily Xerxes sent away his wife Vashti, the queen, because she would not give in to his demand that she appear publicly before a gathering of drunken people. First of all, men, and men who were drunk and carousing. And feeling her dignity as a woman, she refused. Of course, this refusal, as we saw last time, led to Vashti's downfall. That is, she lost her royal throne. Now it may perhaps strike us how something like this could happen, sounding to us today almost like a fairy tale. But if we take into account what a queen was in that era and what a king was, then we would be able to explain a great deal. For the king was the one who governed everything. The queen was simply the king's wife. In the East, she was not a person of any great standing, a person who could play some role of her own. The way today it is the queen who will take counsel with her husband, and so on and so forth. The queen was merely an object of fleshly satisfaction, and nothing more. You will see this, in fact, as the subject unfolds. And so, if the queen did not indulge the king's whims and caprices, she was sent away. This is why we cannot understand the matter if we approach it with our modern picture of a king and a queen. We have to go back to that old reality. Nevertheless, Vashti was dismissed. The king's advisors pressed him very hard, arguing that if the king did not send away his wife, the queen, then their own wives would take this as a bad example and set a precedent so that they would no longer obey their husbands. Saint Nicodemus, the Hagiorite, was right when he notes in the Pedalion, in the sections concerning divorce and so on, that it was men who framed the laws, and so they did not take women into account. For example, that adultery should not be reckoned a grave thing for a man, while it should be reckoned a grave thing for a woman. This is contrary to the gospel, my dear ones. There is no gospel for men and a gospel for women. There is one gospel for all human beings. Therefore, adultery carries the same weight, both for the man and for the woman. If you will, this holds true even today. In our common way of thinking, it is still like this today, and it will always remain. So, what do we say? Let the man have his fun. Let him do as he pleases. But the woman, oh no, why? Why not the woman? Or rather, why should the man be the one to transgress the commandments of God, and not the woman? The man is supposed to break the commandments of God, and not the woman. So you see that we have had the gospel for 2,000 years, and we still have not understood it. It was men who made the laws, says Saint Nicodemus, and they were biased. How much more so in a distant age, and in the East, no less, among hard and rough peoples such as the kings of the Persians, who were harsh kings. So you can understand what this is really about. It is a matter of the sexes. And so the king's wife was sent away, as I told you. And now a new one had to be found. We have a gap of 4 years. This took place in the 3rd year of the reign of Xerxes, and the marriage to a new wife took place in the 7th year of the reign of Xerxes. She is Esther, of whom we are speaking now. Esther's preparation lasted a year. So we have a gap of 2 years. What is this gap? Indeed, the marriage took place in 478, and the dismissal of Vashti took place in 481. How is this gap to be explained? These are the years when Xerxes had campaigned against Greece, and when the naval battle of Salamis was fought in 480 BC, and so on. This is how it is explained. You see how beautifully things fit together in history. This is why Xerxes delayed those years before he married. Of course, here it makes no mention of any of this, no campaign against the Greeks. It says nothing of any naval battle at Salamis, nothing of all these things, but we know them from the Greek writers, such as Herodotus, who gives us many details of the life of the Persians, Xenophon too, and Plutarch. Above all, Xenophon and Herodotus give us many details. In any case, we are in 478 to 479, and it was proposed to the king, for the marriage took place in 478. It was proposed to the king that a new bride be found. The fact that a woman could be chosen from anywhere at all shows you what the position of the queen was within the kingdom and at the side of the king. She was simply the first among many other women in the king's harem. Nothing more at all. Indeed, the queen could fall into disfavor, and the king might pay her no attention whatsoever. And what is more, as we shall see further on, the queen did not have the right to go and seek out the king herself. What wife does not have the right to go and find her own husband? Nor was there the shared table, in the shared bed that husband and wife have today, and whose absence today creates an estrangement between spouses. It was nothing like that. Therefore, the choice was made solely and only for the various fleshly satisfactions of the king. They had to find women from among the people, and naturally even from among the captives, from that vast empire, the Persian one. So a message was sent out that a woman be found, and she had to be, as the sacred text says here, "Let there be sought out for the king, let there be sought out for the king young maidens, undefiled and fair in appearance. They were to be virgins, young girls, and very beautiful." Here the sacred text does not spell the matter out for us, but it emerges at once that this was not a simple public proclamation. Today, we would say it was like a beauty contest, where girls appear whoever we might wish, of course, to compete for the prize of beauty. But it was something quite different. It was rather like the child levy carried out by the Turks, who took the little boys to make them Janissaries. That is to say, there was violence involved. You could not say, if someone saw that your daughter was a beautiful girl, that you could tell her, "My child, go and become a possible queen, or simply go and fill the harem, the women's quarters, of the king." It was not like that. They took your child by force. So there was violence. The sacred text does not say it, but it is clear from the context. This, please note, is very important. It shows on how low a level the woman stood. But beyond this, in order for this woman to be offered to the king, she had to be prepared for a whole year. You will ask me, what sort of preparation is this? For 6 months, she had to have myrrh applied with great care in all of this. We would say, creams and oils and baths and special washings, because she might be some country girl, or I do not know what, and they would work on her, I do not know how, and another 6 months amid the perfumes, so as to become more beautiful than beautiful, to be offered to the king. When a woman is valued in this way, like a product, like something processed, of the ointments, the creams, and the perfumes. Now don't imagine these things belong only to that age. They belong to our own age too. Yes, yes, to our own age as well. How do they belong? Oh, how they belong. When our girl has just finished the gymnasium, just finished high school, and we want to marry her off. How many things do we allow to be done to our girl, with the fashion, the earrings, and all the rest, so that she can find a husband? Don't imagine otherwise. We stand in the very same category, but for us the matter is graver, because we are Christians, far graver. And so, when a girl is valued, as I told you, valued for her perfumes, her creams, and so on, so that she can be offered, this shows how much worth we give to a woman. A woman is not valued by these things. She is valued by what every human being ought to value, by her personality, by who she is as a person. That is, first of all, she is the image of God, and then whether she has qualities, whether she has worth as a human being. Not because we have dressed a girl up, made her over however we made her over, and now we say, "Ah, she suits me. How does she suit you, my dear? Whether she matches your character. And do you want proof that things are wretched?" The multitude of divorces, which shows that our criteria are not right. For if the woman were chosen as a person, as a person, as a character, as a human being, then perhaps we would have no divorces at all. But because the criteria are cheap, they are poor, they are filthy, for this very reason divorces exist as well. In any case, the wretched Esther fell into this category. How did this thing come about? There was a certain man, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin. We could say that the Benjaminites, together with the Judeans, since they belonged to the southern kingdom, were people of the same quality. You will remember our saying that the southern kingdom preserved a considerable piety for at least 100 years longer than the northern kingdom, and that in general, throughout its course, it did not fall into idolatry, as the northern kingdom fell into idolatry. The northern kingdom, which was taken captive by the Ninevites, the Assyrians. And so the southern kingdom had more pious people, and its kings too were more pious than the Assyrians. Mordecai then was a pious man, one of the captives, though he was not himself a captive directly. His great-grandfather had been the captive. That is, in the year 588, the captivity of Jerusalem had taken place under Nebuchadnezzar. By now the Babylonians are no longer here. They were conquered by the Persians. The Babylonians had passed off the stage of history, and we now stand at the year 480. That is, roughly 110 years later. So he is that man's great-grandson, because four of Mordecai's ancestors are named here, and the last of them is Kish, who was taken captive from the southern kingdom. Mordecai, then, is the great-grandson of Kish, and these men were devout. At first, it strikes us that this is the fourth generation still in the captivity. You will say to me, did the captivity last four generations? No, the captivity lasted 70 years. But when the decree was given, by the Persians, not by the Babylonians, that the Hebrews should return to Jerusalem, as Zerubbabel and the others did, not all the Hebrews went back, only a few returned. Most of them preferred to remain in the land of the captivity, because by then they had settled in, they had their routine, as we were saying, and they preferred to stay there, and you know, this was a bad thing. If only they had cast a glance back at their own history, to imitate their forefather Abraham, all of them, my dear ones, would have returned to Jerusalem. Do you know why? Because the Hebrew is, in truth, the man who follows the commandments of God. What did God say to Abram? Go out from your kindred and from your land, from your homeland, and I will show you the place where you shall dwell. But the Hebrews, the descendants of Abram, had by now become people who loved their fields, their comfort, their life. That is, the things of the present age. So you see, some people go off to Australia, some go off to America, and they settle there. How do they begin? You know how they begin. They say, we will go over there, make our money, and come back. But then they settle and 5 or 10 years pass. They come to like it, they have their children, and after that, they never leave. They are rooted there for good. And in the end, when it comes to Scripture, this matters far less to us Greeks than it did to the Jews. Because for the Jew, the land of the promise carried enormous importance. And yet, the heirs of the promise did not return. That is the first thing. The second is that even though four generations had passed, at least at the point in the story where we now stand, and Mordecai is the fourth descendant of the man who was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, even so, he keeps a tradition of piety. My beloved, do not leave Greece. Do not leave. But if you do leave, be careful. I don't know. No one is forbidden to go. There are no religious reasons against it either. It is good for us to be here. As I told you, for once you are abroad, take care that we preserve our spiritual tradition in our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren as far as we are able, because our children usually adapt to the new climate and do not take up what their parents hold. Of course, in our day these things are very difficult. I would be most unjust if I did not say this and did not know it. It is very difficult, but it seems to me that where there are well-grounded parents, parents who truly ache for their children to be saved, not merely to get established, but to be saved, then they will surely attend to this point. And so Mordecai is a pious man, a zealous man, as his story will show us further on. He had a young girl, not his daughter, but the daughter of his father's brother, and therefore his first cousin. Her name was Esther, Esther in Hebrew, and in both Hebrew and Persian, it corresponds to the Greek word Aster, which means star. She was the daughter of Aminadab, who was Mordecai's uncle. She was a wonderful maiden. Indeed, the maiden was fair in appearance. A shapely girl, a very beautiful girl, and he raised her from her early years. Her parents, it seems, had died. The sacred text tells us nothing more. In any case, she was a foster child. Say a foster child. A kind of. Well, here the matter shifts about many times in the Hebrew text, and we cannot always pin it down with precision, like the question of niece or cousin. It appears he had adopted her, or else he simply raised her because he was making her his wife, for it says a little further on that he trained her up for himself as a wife. That is, he had helped her to become a sound person so that he might take her as his wife. But as I told you, in the sacred text, the question of kinship is never clearly stated, when today we say nephew, uncle, cousin, and so on. Here in the sacred text and in other books of the Old Testament, the matter is somewhat unclear. But the fact that it says for himself as a wife rather rules out the case of adoption. It rather rules it out, for if he had adopted her, how could he marry his own child? Yet notice this. It is striking. He trained her up for himself as a wife. He formed her. He schooled her in order to make her his wife. She was, of course, younger, perhaps considerably younger than his own age. It is what we call forming her in character, forming her as a person in order to make her his wife, Would you like to see the contrast between the people of God and the people of the world, how the kings and the Persians prepared women to make them their wives, with perfumes, with creams and lotions, and as I told you, a whole year of it. But Mordecai forms his prospective wife. He trained her, not by dunking her in a bath of milk to freshen her skin, but he trained her. He schooled the maiden. So then, do not fatten up your daughters to make them plump and pampered so as to offer them as brides. Form them so that they become persons. Otherwise, it is mere flesh that you are offering. You are not offering a person, a human being, but flesh. And this is a fearful thing. It is a debasement. Would you want your daughter to be debased, to become merchandise? No, I do not think so. But am I to say that you would do it? Of course, we always say others do it. Others are the guilty ones. Yet if I put it to you that this is a grievous thing, because our Christians, sometimes false Christians, people who for whole years have heard the word of God, cook up such things, what would you say? I tell you that many times it disheartens me when I see Christian mothers, women who have been confessing for years, thinking in this way, my lady, you are going to offer a human being, a person, not flesh. So then he trained her up for himself as a wife. But there is something more I must tell you. What I am about to say is not absolute. Many times a man says, I will take a girl, but I will shape her myself. There is some weight to this, but very little. Xenophon, for instance, in his O Economicus, says that there he shapes his wife, helping her to learn how to manage her household. But mark me well, marriage is not a place where we conduct an experiment. We do not enter into marriage unprepared, so as to get ourselves ready afterward. Into marriage we enter already prepared. It is one thing for there to be a few small shortcomings and for us to say we will smooth them out together. But take note of this. Let us never say, I will shape my wife myself, or I will shape my husband myself. You take a man who blasphemes, a man who never goes to church, a man who is I do not know what. And you say, because you are drawn to him, because he is rich, because you love him, because he is handsome, you say, I will shape him. I assure you that you will suffer for it. I have seen women who wail over it, and do you know what they confessed? They said it themselves. Ah, I was proud. I imagined that I would shape my husband. I never managed it. And so we counsel you, into marriage we enter, already prepared. And the command of the king went out, that girls were to be chosen. Here it does not tell us in so many words, but it was a violent rounding up of girls. Yet when we see that Mordecai, for his part, is preparing a woman who is to become his own wife, how could he ever possibly offer her to the king? Is it ever possible? Three things argue against it. First, that he is preparing Esther to become his own wife. Second, Deuteronomy forbade an Israelite woman to be given to an idolater. And third, since Esther was his kinswoman, the law again said that the inheritance was not to pass into a foreign tribe. Supposing he had wished to take an Israelite, a Hebrew woman, but one from another tribe, the inheritance had to remain within the same tribe, the same kin, the same family. These three reasons, then, argue the point, and since Mordecai shows himself a keeper of the commandments of God, this, we might say, is a fourth argument. They argue that Mordecai did not offer Esther, as though he would say, I have heard this command. Come along, my girl. Let me take you to find your fortune. No, my dear, the pious Hebrew does not think in terms of such fortune. For him it is no fortune at all. And yet the girl was given up, or rather found herself, in the hands of the chief eunuch who was gathering the girls, Guy he was called, the one charged with selecting the finest girls and preparing them, that year. Long preparation, I mentioned to you, so that they might be offered to the king. And so the poor Esther found herself within the women's quarters of the king, difficult things indeed. But sometimes, within these harsh and difficult things, there lies the plan of God. God's plan is far-reaching. Sometimes we watch a misfortune unfold before us, a misfortune. And I do not mean merely a car accident, but something in life that we would not have wanted when things come at us all the wrong way. And then we say, what a calamity. How many times this happens and God either permits it or wills it. He has two wills, either he permits it or he wills it, so that it may become the starting point of a plan of his providence. And this I do not say on my own. Mordecai himself will say it here. Further on, he will say it to Esther when the fitting moment comes, the fullness of time. He will tell her, he will say, now I understand. God chose you to become queen so that you might play a part. You know that we human beings cannot, we have a finite mind, and we do not know the counsels of God. God knows all things. God sees the whole of history. For with God there is no time, past, present, and future. All of it lies open before him. We cannot, therefore, know how God is at work. But when the hour comes, the hour for the chief thing God wills to be accomplished, then it is revealed, not everything, but much of it is revealed to the eyes of men, of pious men, that it was the love, the providence of God, that wrought these things. And then, you know what? We have, of course, we do not then have the philosophy of history that stands outside the courtyard of God. It has its worth, but it stands outside the courtyard of God. What we then have is the theology of history, and the whole of Holy Scripture is nothing other than a theology of history. The Hebrew, in the Old Testament, theologizes upon history. He always asks why this chastisement came about, and answers, because he transgressed the commandments of God. He theologizes upon history, upon the events. And so Mordecai will say, it seems, he now senses it, that God chose you to play a part. And as I told you last time, Esther is a type of the most holy Theotokos. And just as the most holy Theotokos played a part in our salvation, a foundational and essential part, so too Esther played a part in the salvation of her people. The most holy Theotokos, for the salvation of the people of God, those who would hear the voice of Christ and be saved. These are the people of God. And so Mordecai has only a few things to say to Esther, and they are most weighty. Listen to me, he told her. You will not say that you are Jews. You will keep it hidden. That is, neither your homeland nor your people. And as for her people, she could be a Jews without coming from Palestine. She could be a Jews of the diaspora from many years back. I don't know exactly. You will not even mention your homeland, that we came here 4 generations back from Jerusalem, nor even that you are a Jews. Take care. These 2 things you will not say. And listen, she kept them. As it says, Esther did not reveal her people, nor her homeland, for Mordecai had commanded her not to tell. Mordecai instructed her, you will say nothing. And she said nothing, she held it in. Here we have obedience to Mordecai's commands. It is a little glimpse, a small crack through which we can see, what upbringing Mordecai had given to Esther. Do you want something more still? A crack into Esther's soul as well, where we see that Esther had one fundamental and basic virtue. And if a person does not have it, he simply cannot be taught. It makes no difference if he sat for 500 years in this chair, 500 years in this chair, incapable of learning. It goes in one ear and out the other. What is this virtue? Humility and obedience. You saw it. Esther obeyed, Mordecai told me. That settles it. I will make nothing known. She had obedience, and for that reason, I said she was most receptive to teaching. And she became a great character, a great person, a great woman, even though she found herself in the harem of a barbarian king. Mordecai, of course, could no longer have direct contact with her. But he did keep in touch with her, indirectly, through the women who served, through certain eunuchs and men and others who served there. He had some contact, though not the most direct. He could not. That is why it says that Mordecai walked about every day near the courtyard, the women's courtyard, watching to see what would happen to Esther. He went every day to learn the news, to see how things stood with Esther. He kept watch over her, to see what would come next. The man was in anguish. You see, people who love, people who truly care. Let me say something now. Since it is the start of the school year, a new law has come out. I heard it. I heard that now all the primary school children will pass. Will anyone be held back a grade? What joyous news. Where are the children in this? No one will be held back. Unless he has very many sins. I mean absences, that is, if the school days number 200 and he is absent for 198, meaning he shows up at school only twice a year, then of course, he will be kept in the same grade. Otherwise, he is not held back in the same grade. I don't know. I am no pedagogue. I am no educator. I am not the right person to judge. But from what I can tell, all these laws are meant to cast us down into illiteracy. That is how I understand it with my poor mind. That is what I think, and I may be wrong. Perhaps it is a wise policy, but I see them as dangerous laws, insidious ones, out to pull us down. Be that as it may, which child, I ask you, which child today is going to study? As for the child, the wisdom of Sirach says, you shall bend the neck of your son. Because the child is. Do you know what the child is? The child is the true child of Adam. He is man after the fall, fallen man. He must be cultivated. Know that if the child is not set within the framework of proper upbringing, how will he become a real human being? When I say everything is turned into a free-for-all, where is the upbringing? How is upbringing even understood anymore? What, after all, is this freedom? Which child will study today? I ask you. Suppose you have a child. You will say to your children, my child, sit down and study, and tomorrow, what will you say? The teacher will call on you in class, and you had better know the lesson. And the child will say, so what? Either way, I will be promoted. One day, we will simply file an application to be handed a university degree. And in the application, we will add a plea in a postscript at the bottom that, so we need not even take the trouble to go and collect the degree. They should mail it to us, once we have covered the postage. That is where things will end up. Illiteracy, and this is exactly what our enemies want. They will enslave us through our illiteracy, through the loss of our historical memory, and so on and so forth. They are cutting us off from our roots. You understand? So, my dear ones, this is how it stands at the start of the school year. We are in September, and the private schools have opened. If Mordecai had been allowed to see Esther, he would have seen her face to face, but he is not allowed. So he goes and asks from outside every day, tell me, do you ever go to the school to ask how your child is doing? Do you go? And even so, up to this year, at least a report card could still be sent home, and a notice that the child will be held back a grade, that he isn't studying. Now that things are becoming so lax, tell me, do we go and ask? I have quite a few listeners here who are teachers, women and men, present, right here. Do you know what their complaint is? That the parents should come and ask how their child is doing, not come to quarrel with the teacher, the woman or the man, because she imposed this or that on the child, or scolded the child. If I called on some teacher right now, a man or a woman, they would tell you, because we know, they have said it. Let a teacher stand up now and say, I scolded a child, and his father came and cursed me. If we go and abuse the teacher, woe to us, take note, we are not defending our child, we are only abusing the teacher. If we take this stance, woe to us, we are being selfish, and we will pay dearly for it. Our child will grow into a vulgar egoist. Instead, we should go and work together with the teacher, the man and the woman. We should earnestly ask them to help our child and to tell us how he is doing. And when the child, the teacher, forgive me, when the teacher tells us the child isn't studying, that he isn't doing well, let us not say to the teacher, it is your fault, because that is what some parents do, and I will tell you this as well, allow me to say it. Many times the teachers cannot speak up today. You know, they cannot speak up, because the parents go straight to the inspector. And the teacher says to herself, any day, now I could get transferred somewhere else, so what do I care whether the child learns his letters or not? Why should I have to put up with any trouble from the inspector? So the parents go and say to the teacher, you, the other day, my child isn't learning his letters. Now this teacher, who supposedly isn't teaching your child his letters, first of all, why do you say such a thing? The fault is your own. You don't know how to bring up your own children. I have parents right here who have their children in school, and that is why I'm telling you these things. You're the local branch of the association here. You're in Larissa. I have parents, and because I hear so many stories over and over again, I'm going to say these things out loud. I have a great deal in mind, and that is why I'm telling you, my dear. I surround the teacher with much tenderness, with much love. He is someone who suffers for his work, and the honest, upright teacher truly suffers for the children. Believe me, there is no more exhausting profession, no more exhausting labor than the labor of the good dear teacher and educator I love so much. Now then, Mordecai would go every single day to see how Esther was doing. For a whole year he went, right up until this fearful ordeal, this preparation, was to take place. The time came, the days passed, and Esther was to be presented, together with other young women, of course, before the king, so that he himself could make his choice. When Esther appeared, she immediately drew the king's attention. For Esther was finding favor in the eyes of all who beheld her. So this favor, what was it? Something roughly like a beauty pageant, you see. You see, we condemn Xerxes, and yet we ourselves hold beauty pageants and put beauty on display. In any case, these people were captives. Esther was a captive, forced into all this. But this favor, in the eyes of all, what kind of grace was it? There are beautiful people, my dear ones, who, as they say, measure women with every measuring tape to find the right proportions, so that the winner comes out first in the contest. But if you look at such a face and it turns out to be a cold face, then you see that this grace does not refer so much to outward qualities. It refers to the soul, which pours itself outward. In other words, it is the seal of the personality. Esther had personality. She was not merely a beautiful girl, she had personality. And that is the weight of the matter. That is the grace. When Holy Scripture uses the word grace, it does not mean what the word has fallen to today. A charming person. Where our mind does not even go, when someone says, a charming girl, our mind does not even go to the graces of God, to the grace of the Holy Spirit, but only charming, meaning pretty, lively, and so on. No, my dear ones, she had the grace of God. If you like, this beauty is a blessing of God, but it fits so fully within the framework of virtue. And so at once Esther became the focus, and Esther went in to Xerxes. I told you that this comes from Xerxes, a mistake of the translators. It is Xerxes, to Xerxes the king, in the 12th month in which she underwent her trial, which is Adar, in the 7th year of his reign. In the 7th year of the reign, you see, and the king loved Esther, the king loved her, he loved her, and he placed upon her the diadem of the women. He set upon her the woman's crown of the queen. She was crowned queen, and the king held a reception and a banquet for 7 days. And he exalted the wedding of Esther, that is, he gave honor to this wedding of his, and he also granted a remission to those under his rule, those well-known measures, a lightening of taxes. Perhaps he even released some prisoners from the prisons, and so on and so forth. And so, Esther is the queen. So had she ever seen in her dream that she would become queen, queen of the Persian realm, even if that queen was not what a queen is today, like the Queen of England, or even though she had a king for a husband, nonetheless, did Esther see this in her dream? As they say in common speech, not even in your dreams, and yet God raised her up. Why? God has his plan. But there, amid the celebrations, how many handmaids, how many servant girls, how many attendants, and how many eunuchs must have worked for her? She rose high, did she become proud? My dear ones, notice this, hear it once more. Esther, forgive me, Mordecai now again does not see her. But he is nonetheless inside the palace, perhaps an official, perhaps not. The Greek text is not clear. He was serving in the court, it says, perhaps an official. But Esther did not disclose her homeland. For so Mordecai had commanded her. That is how Mordecai told her, take care, you will not say where you come from or who you are. Now listen to something else. What did Mordecai command her? To fear God and to do his commandments, to fear God and to keep his commandments. Mordecai, you are out of touch with reality. You are out of touch with reality. Now your niece, who is inside the palace under such conditions, the well-known conditions, what are you saying now? To fear God and to keep God's commandments. How could she possibly keep God's commandments? And yet this is exactly what Mordecai commands her. She will fear God and she will keep the commandments. And here is something else they say to him, Mordecai, you are out of touch with reality. Why not just sit still now, captive that you are? Gnaw on a bone in the royal courts and keep quiet. But Mordecai does not think that way. Mordecai is not the one out of touch with reality. The ones out of touch with reality are those who bite at the bait that hides the devil's hook and it catches them, so that they come to love this present age. That is the bait. That is where the devil hooks them, to make them love this age and become the people of the fall. And there is something else. What does the scripture say about her? While she was with him, Esther did not change her way of life. Oh my, my, my. Did you hear that? Just as it was in the time when Esther lived with Mordecai, she did not change her manner of life. Truly this is heroism. Blessed are the girls, and blessed are the young people who, in our times, can hold high the banner of faith, of the spiritual life, and of purity. Blessed are these young ones, however high they may rise, If they likewise hold high the banner of Christ, they are blessed. I think you should have no other object for your prayers for your children, at the very least, than this. Pray, of course, that your children succeed in their schools. But tell me, when you send your children off to become university students, and then they drag themselves along the sidewalks like drug addicts, like corrupt ones, like politicized ones, like this and like that, what would you say? Would you say you would rather your children still be students? Or do you say 1,000 times over, let my son be a shoeshine boy and my daughter a seamstress, rather than a philologist and a lawyer, and I do not know what else? Would you say that? But this is your great success, not that your child reaches the point of studying. Your child, if he studies, will either go out into life tomorrow or will attain high positions. Let him attain positions. Why should he not? But take care. Let him hold high the banner of Christ. This has very great value and very great significance. If you stand in this way, my dear ones, then one day at the end of your life, you will be able to say to God, Lord, you gave me some children, 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, however many you gave me. Let me tell you only this one thing, of the children you gave me, I lost not one. I did not lose a single one. Here are the children, I hand them back to you. Sometimes, and the misfortune, may God forgive me, I will say it, is when you ask clergy, may God forgive me. Father, how are you? How are you doing? Glory to God. I am very well. I have, say, 3 children. All 3 of my children became professionals. They hold great positions. They have good salaries. Glory to God. I am a successful man. I have nothing else to ask of God. There we stop, my dear father. There we stop. They simply have good positions and good salaries. A misfortune, a misfortune, a misfortune. When the devil sees good things, my dear ones, he envies them. He envies what is good. The devil envies them. It is what the wisdom of Sirach again says, that the envious eye darkens the good things, the evil eye blackens them. The devil is envious, and he has many people as his instruments who are ready to serve his plans. To serve his plans, amid all these fine things, where Esther is queen and Mordecai is at her side, but without any of it becoming known. They know nothing, perhaps some people know something, but they are very few. The matter is kept quiet. 2 eunuchs of the king grew resentful. Now tell me, with the things we are recounting about the conduct and the behavior of Esther and of Mordecai, will you leave saddened on account of these 2 persons? No, I rejoice. These 2 grew resentful. It is envy. Not this kind of grief. They grew resentful. Listen, the chief bodyguards, eunuchs of the king, why? Because Mordecai had been promoted, and they sought, they kept seeking, to kill Artaxerxes the king. Wait, I am not certain now. How was Mordecai promoted? First of all, there was already the promotion of his relative. Let us say his daughter, let us say his niece, his cousins. She had become queen. And he, well, he was inside the palace after all. Quietly, but they grew envious. So you see that they grew resentful because he had been promoted. Do you want to know whether at some point you have fallen into sorrow? There are many kinds of sorrow. If we feel sorrow over another person's good, know this well. It is 100% 24-carat, we might say, envy. When you feel pain simply because you saw someone else doing well, that is envy. And if we do not run quickly to root it out, woe to us. In any case, where were these men now to turn? They turned against Mordecai. But they could not kill the queen. So what did they devise? They aimed higher and set out to assassinate Artaxerxes, Xerxes, to murder him. Besides, it is well known that not only in the courts of the Persians, but in the other courts as well, not only in the East, though far more in the East, intrigues and assassinations were not rare in the royal courts. And so they hatched a plan to assassinate Xerxes. Mordecai heard of it, he understood what was afoot, and he sent word, a message to Esther, that they were plotting to kill the king. See that you tell him. So Esther told the king, and there he ordered an investigation. At once the men were seized, and he had them hanged and put to death. Let me stay here a little. Did Mordecai do well to go and denounce them? Was he an informer, as they say? That man is an informer. My dear ones, there are cases where we will not speak, which the general public calls being an informer. But there are cases where we will give an account to God if we do not speak. Let us know this. When we see people preparing evil, we will expose them. Know this. We will not cover for people who are preparing evil, because otherwise we too become co-responsible. So Mordecai did well to reveal the plan of assassination. You will tell me that he had his own interests. Of course, people who always want to find a justification will find one. Yes, of course he had his own interests at stake. His cousin had become queen, and Mordecai stood to lose everything, so it was to his advantage to speak, but that is not the point. The point is that when we become aware of evil, we must bring it to light. The king, of course, showed the two eunuchs no mercy and simply had them hanged. You see that the monarchs of that time were indeed barbaric. They had terrible faults. With a single command, he could put a whole people to death, as we shall see further on. But they also had good qualities. Today there is no one who is 100% evil, and the king commanded that a record be entered as a memorial in the royal library. In honor of Mordecai's good service with words of praise, the king gave orders that this deed of Mordecai be entered into the royal archives, and this, too, was the providence of God. Mordecai, that is, with commendation, with praise for having done this good deed, and so on. Notice something. Such things often happen, and the proud man takes it upon himself. The humble man does not. The genuine man will not rush to say, "Oh, don't write it down. Don't put it in the book of praises." No, no. There is only one thing that matters, that I not take it upon myself. God allowed it. No. God did not merely allow it. It is precisely within the plan of God. Because this very record that will be preserved, this good deed of Mordecai, will become the means of salvation, not only for Mordecai later on against his enemies, but for all the Jews throughout the whole Persian Empire. Everything, you see, is placed into the service of God. God works all things. Here, then, we will stop where the second chapter also ends, and we will see what finally became of this whole story. Mordecai remains in happiness. Esther remains in happiness, but here the matter was set right. These two men had been envious, but behind these two were there no others, my dear ones. And with a great grudge, in fact, right there inside the palace. A very great grudge indeed. There were those who would not rest, and Mordecai and Esther would find themselves in terrible danger. And then God would step in and use all those things that his love and his providence had been preparing along the course of events, so that not only these two people would be saved, but all the Jews as well. But these things, God willing, we will speak of at our next meeting. Today, by telephone, our preacher called me and told me this. Do you remember that in the newspaper he had published some articles against the Honites, that is, the Hon of Larissa, who are Protestants? As you know, under the direction of Hesiodus and so on, we had dealt with the subject very thoroughly. These articles, at the urging of many, he wants to turn into a small volume, a little booklet, so we can hand it out around our diocese. This has been in the works for a while now. Of course, the idea was already there back at the start of the summer. And now, with the new school year coming up, people are rallying together, and they want to get it printed.